start before it's perfect. And that is acknowledging that, A, perfection doesn't exist, so it will never be perfect. And B, if you don't start, you will not have the opportunity for progress at all. So, you know, when I started the podcast, I had zero guests. I had zero experience podcasting or podcast editing or writing questions. And now I'm 3 years deep and I've won an award and I've done 100 episodes. But none of those things would have happened had I not started way before it was perfect. Like way, when it was basically an experiment.
Welcome to this podcast with me, Nikki Hutchison, that's going to take you from overlooked to fully booked. Today is a guest episode, and I'm really delighted to finally be speaking to today's guest, Nikki Denson-Elliott, after months of trying and failing. We're doing a podcast swap, and we're going to be recording both episodes back to back, so that made finding a time a little challenging. And if you don't know Nikki already, she calls herself the professional feminist. And I believe is on a mission, we'll check this with her, but I believe she's on a mission to close the gender confidence gap. Nikki also hosts the Wilder Collective membership, an event called Wilder Live, and of course, her own podcast, Women's Business. So welcome to the show, Nikki.
Thank you so much for having me, Nikki.
This is going to be weird. All right. So I am really curious, and you're very open, I think, about your business journey and it all starting with a podcast. And am I right in thinking you've been growing that for nearly 3 years?
Yeah, I think I figured out actually that it's 3 years this week.
Oh, that's exciting. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
And how did it all begin? What was that motivation or that moment?
So the podcast came out of a previous business, which we can talk about in a mo. But essentially, I was running a different business, a kids' clothing brand. I know that you've had a fascinating career pivot as well around supporting kids. And when I decided to wind up that business, the thing that stayed with me was the women I'd met running their own businesses as well. The conversations I'd had with them, the way they were building their lives around their families, being exposed to a whole network of women that I just didn't know existed before because I wasn't in that world. And I found talking to them so helpful in my business, like tangibly helpful, so heartening and so supportive. And I just really felt like we needed to hear more of their stories in the business space, their whole stories, you know, from when they were young through to what they do now with all the messy middle. And so I started the podcast really to bring some of the conversations that I was fortunate enough to be having in the DMs to other people as well. And that clearly landed and resonated. And it's sort of the seed from which the rest of my business as it is now grew.
So how did you commercialize that?
I didn't for quite a long time. The podcast was a massive passion project, and I am always really open about that, about how long it can take to get somewhere and normalizing the process. And for me, whilst I was getting the podcast off the ground and paying various monthly subscriptions for hosting and recording, I was doing bits and bobs of social media work for other people. I was doing like VA style work, stuff that I sort of learned off the back of the clothing brand. And also I had an events and marketing background. But I did get to a point where I started charging sponsorship for the podcast to kind of cover its costs. And then the Wilder Collective that you mentioned, my online paid community, is my main revenue stream. And really that exists because of the podcast and because of the conversations I was having, the community of listeners that I managed to build. 2 years ago, nearly, I said, shall we all get together in London? I'm going to host a networking. And you were there.
Was that your first one? I'd forgotten that.
That was the first one.
Amazing.
Yeah. And people came and they said, this was so great. Can we all have access to each other? And I'd had this idea in the back of my head for the Wilder Collective. And that was the moment I decided to say, yeah, actually, this is a scalable business model. It will enable me to keep doing the podcast, which is a small revenue stream, but is indirectly kind of the reason that I have the business. So it's absolutely worthwhile doing. And yeah, that was kind of how I actually started turning it into a standalone business.
Brilliant. So I call myself unemployed sometimes, or maybe unemployable, because I don't have a job, right? I create my own work and I've been unemployed since 2010, nearly 16 years. So you've been unemployed for how long?
For the second time around since 2020, I set up my first business in 2011 when I was still in my 20s. I've just said 20 a lot. So I was unemployed, quote unquote, for a while back then. And then that business was bought out. And then when I was on maternity leave for the second time in 2020, I never went back to my big job after that. So that was when I set up the unisex kids clothing brand, and everything that became this, gestures wildly, is when that all started. So 6 years ago is the short answer.
That's exactly the same as me, actually. The second bit is that I never went back to employment after my second child. Okay, so let's talk about entrepreneurship. I did some stories about this yesterday, about the fact that I believe we as entrepreneurs possess something that I call delusional optimism.
Like that?
It's crucial, right? Because it is such a journey, it's such a roller coaster. But there are lots of beliefs around entrepreneurship. So have you got any beliefs that you held at the start that you maybe now think, actually, maybe that wasn't that healthy or wasn't quite right?
I don't know if I held this belief, but I know that a lot of people do believe that entrepreneurship isn't even a viable career path, or it's something bigger than what people think it is because it's quite a long, fancy word. But actually, at the root of it, it's just self-employment, it's creating your own work. And I think what I definitely did have was limiting beliefs about what I could make it. I think at the beginning, I was focused on how to make my work life work around my kids.
Yeah.
And I had left a really, really long commute and a high pressure job. And since I've got into the swing of running the business, and I've absolutely love my work now, and I've really lent into what I'm good at and what serves me and what feels easeful, not easy, I've realised that there is no limit to what I can achieve. And I mean that financially, and I mean that in terms of impact. And I think I definitely didn't have that on my radar when I started out. I think I was quite modest in my aims and goals. And now I don't feel the opposite. I don't feel like, oh my God, hold me back, I'm about to change the world. But I do just feel like it's in my hands and it's up to me. And I don't have that limiting belief in the same way now.
And you talk a lot about women undercharging. And actually, we know that that applies across the board. I was reading online today about new research conducted ahead of International Women's Day that showed that 60% of employed women have never asked for a pay rise, and were not offered them either, by the way. And almost a quarter of women in their 30s and 40s have turned down a promotion or a new job because it wouldn't work with their family life. But also, as self-employed / unemployed women, we don't charge enough either. So I'd love to hear if there's ever been a moment that you can remember where you really undercharged for something. And was there some kind of story that you were telling yourself that made you do it?
I think for me, when I launched the community, that's a volume model, right? It's low cost, so you need relatively high volume. So it's like I was undercharging for that, just in terms of the value that it can offer people. And I was very, very preoccupied with making it accessible for women and startup founders. And I'm sure loads of my conditioning around sort of being likable and being palatable was all mixed up in that, because I did a research project last summer called Good Girl Economics, and pricing was such a huge part of what came out of those conversations. And we did qual and quant research, so we did both. And in the qualitative, almost every woman spoke about how she knew there was value in her work. She understood what she was really, really good at. But there was a massive disconnect between that and what she felt able to charge and where she was confident charging. And women were totally pricing for safety and not in line with their skill and their actual sort of objective value. So I've definitely been on that journey myself. And that research has enabled me to go, oh, no, there is value in the community. It's still a low cost, high volume model, so it is still accessible, but it's not just stupidly cheap anymore. And I definitely was doing that from a place of like me.
And it's a vicious cycle as well, isn't it? Because it's definitely a journey that I've been on, where you want to charge more, but you also, it feels risky because you might either lose, and I've been on the receiving end of this, working with freelancers as well, where they've said nervously, oh, I'm putting my prices up, kind of, is that going to be okay? Yeah, if you get trapped, basically. And it is this kind of race to the bottom, isn't it? If you don't deal with this pricing issue.
Yeah, and I think for a lot of women, and the reframe that's been really helpful for me is, like, I now outsource the first edit of my podcast. Someone does that for me and I pay her. I pay a brilliant woman to do that. I wouldn't be able to afford that if I was still playing very small. And if you sort of res that up to a bigger worldview in terms of the impact that we really, really need women to have now more than ever, like, we need to feel the impact of the way that women spend their money, because when women have money, they do more good with it. And that impacts their family in a microcosmic way, and it impacts their wider community. And obviously that can ripple and ripple. And so if you can't hold money and charge money for yourself, can you think about the impact you're going to have beyond you? If you have more money, you will spend more money, and you will spend it with the people that reflect your values back to you. And I think that's been really, really helpful for me, is actually doing that is so important. And I can't do that if I'm over here counting my pennies.
And is there anything else that you would say to somebody? Because these are conversations that I often have with women in business where they're just starting out, or they haven't been in business very long and they don't have as many clients as they want to have. So that in itself makes them nervous. How can I possibly raise my prices before I've even got fully booked? What would you say to them?
I would say, that's okay to feel like that. I think we can all want, like, quick fixes and, like, fast solutions, and actually feeling your feelings and actually interrogating them is helpful to you, because there will be information inside those feelings that will tell you that there's probably something deeper going on. But it is okay to start somewhere, and it is okay to charge less than your value in the beginning if you want some evidence. You know, you want evidence of your competence and you want to build that confidence muscle. So don't let it be another thing that you beat yourself up with. Equally, look objectively at the skills you're bringing to the table, because you might have not run this as a business before, but you've probably been building up these skills for years and years in other ways, or in another industry or another role. And the value in those skills is there, whether you've been self-employed before or not. So I would say, look at it as if it was your best friend's business and she was running her pricing past you. You know, what would you say felt like a good level? Absolutely compare your prices to other people in the market. Crucially, compare your prices to what men are charging, because that was another thing that came out of my research. Every woman I spoke to, I said, how do you set your pricing? They were like, oh, sort of, you know, ask Google and look at what other people are charging. And I was like, do you look at what men are charging? Every single woman that I spoke to said, oh, no, I don't do that. That is where the gender pay gap is the biggest, is in self-employed people. So as much as this research coming out about women in employment have never asked for a pay rise and never been given one, the gender pay gap is biggest amongst self-employed women. When women are setting the rates, women are the problem. It's not their fault. It is the conditioning piece. But that's why it's absolutely vital to look at the full picture and price yourself fairly.
And I actually think that applies to marketing in general. And looking at the way that men in your industry are not holding back when it comes to promoting themselves. They are quite literally full steam ahead. And how can we, that's not to say that, you know, everything they're doing is right, far from it, and vice versa. But certainly, I think it's a good reminder that that difference exists as well, and that is affecting our earning power and our success as well.
Absolutely, and we've got evidence for it. You know, as women, we fear being visible because we've been brought up being told that it is kind of unsafe and it is unpalatable to be visible. And then on the other hand, we've got all these marketing gurus saying, be visible, show your face, get out there. And it's totally natural and normal that there would be a disconnect there. It can be really, really hard, and it feels much riskier for women than it is for men, because it is riskier for women. and than it is for men. And I don't mean in the sense of like their actual safety is at risk, but that is what it feels like to women. Because what is at risk is women are picked apart. There is no redemption narrative for women. Like, women are under much harsher microscopes than men. So it isn't a level playing field. And that's why it doesn't feel like one. You know, it isn't one. And it is absolutely important to recognize that, because if you set out in your business setting your rates and thinking, oh my God, like, I feel all these things, but I have to ignore all those feelings and just get on with it and do what everyone's telling me. Like, no, that's not going to serve you. I think being aware of this stuff is step one, because then you can interrogate it, understand it, and move forward in your business with your marketing strategy, with your pricing, with the way that you structure, you know, your offers, with knowledge and clarity. And your customers want that clarity from you as well, right? So it's like it works the whole way around.
Yeah, 100%. And I always, when I'm working with people, I always say to them, look, I'm never going to force you to do anything. I'm going to tell you what I believe will work. And anything that you do not believe is going to work for you for whatever reason, we'll navigate that. Like, we'll find a way around. You do not have to be shouting in people's faces all day if that is not going to work for you, your business, your brand. But let's talk about a visibility method or a tactic maybe that you personally have resisted. Have there been any of those?
I think that I've always been comfortable being visible in my business because I've enjoyed some of the sort of performative aspects of it. I just have that like aspect of my personality. But I have been very worried about being received well within that visibility. And actually, when you do the work that I do, which is feminist work and sort of feminist thought leadership, you are going to talk about things that are going to sting for certain people, that are going to rub them up the wrong way or make them, you know, hold a mirror up to themselves in a way that's uncomfortable. And therefore, you may say things that aren't immediately liked, that aren't that palatable. And I think I was very preoccupied to begin with, like I said, not in the being visible, but in the being liked, in the visibility. And that will have held me back from saying certain things, which I'm not saying them to be inflammatory on purpose, but I am saying them to hold a mirror up to society and to get people to think differently about things. And if you want to do that, you do have to share some uncomfortable truths and have some difficult conversations. I think I really held back on that to begin with, more than the actual visibility. But I think with anything, it is a muscle that you build, and you can build your resilience around these things. And if even the concept of visibility is hard, you will start somewhere and you will make progress, and you just have to start in order to start seeing that progress.
And you mentioned thought leadership, and it's definitely a space that I see you in. Has that been intentional right from the very start? And if yes, where did that drive come from?
No, is the answer.
Okay.
But now, yes. And I lead into that because I think thought leadership, that's a bit icky. But why is it icky? I think because other people say that. And actually, when I interrogate that, no, it doesn't bother me that much. You just have to stand on it. I didn't set out to do it, but with the podcast, I thought that I would be good at it. I thought that I would hold space for women, and I thought I would ask them good questions and have good conversations. I thought the podcast could be good and fun. And then the way that I started sharing what came off the back of those conversations, that happened very, very organically. And that's what's led me to kind of where I am now. So it wasn't a grand plan. And I think it's really difficult to have a grand plan in business. I think a plan is good, but I think unless you're willing to deviate from the plan, you're pretty much doomed because stuff changes. And I think one of the joys of being self-employed, unemployed, is, like you said, we don't have jobs. Like, we make the work. We make it up as we go along. That stuff was interesting to me. It felt like there were threads that were worth pulling on. I did. People responded to that. I did more of it. You know, I got asked to write. I got asked to speak. Like, that snowballed in a really, really positive way. So it wasn't a plan, but it was a thread that I followed, if that makes sense.
And does it help you to keep showing up, the fact that you've got, like, we hear all the time, work out what your bigger mission is and you'll be able to market yourself with greater ease. Does that help you to know that you are showing up for a bigger purpose than purely yourself?
I think it does help me, and it's really only fully come together for me in the last year, really. Like, 3 years of doing the podcast, nearly 2 years of doing the community, it's still a baby, right? It's still really, really new. But the way that things have started to come together, and then the positive reinforcement of, yeah, no, that is good and that is resonating. And then people will message me and be like, oh, I feel like you're really onto something at the moment, or I really like what you're talking about. I love your content. You know, that then keeps you moving forward and you think, no, I am onto something. I definitely felt at certain points at the beginning, there was like too many strands to my business and I wasn't quite sure where I was at. And I've kind of let that go because actually I think there is a unifying thread to my work, which is sort of feminist thought leadership, specifically with like a women working for themselves angle. And there's so much to say in that space, and all of the work that I do and the various revenue streams are all relevant to that. So that's enough as a kind of red thread, if you want to call it that, to keep me moving forward and feel like I do have that purpose. But to answer your question, yes, I actually do think it is helpful, but I didn't focus on it. It was almost like it happened concomitantly, like people were talking about that and I was like, oh, I don't know if I have that. And then I did have that and I was like, oh yeah, it is better.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about your business and what is working really brilliantly right now that maybe you haven't shared before. Can you think of anything?
I think what has always worked for me is bringing my whole self to my work, being very transparent and very real and whole and messy, and you know, bringing sort of all of me, obviously within the boundaries of like what I'm comfortable with, but not being one of these super glossy women who always has her lipstick on. I'm not dissing those women, but for me, like the rawness and the reality of like looking like trash on the school run and then also dressing up for an event, like it, and all the messy middle in between is, I think, what resonates with people. And I've always pitched myself as, you know, I'm not a psychologist, I'm not an expert, I'm you, I'm an every woman, I'm a mother, I'm a wife, I'm living this with you, I'm learning this with you. You know, I'm only slightly ahead in terms of what I'm learning. I don't mean ahead in any other way. And then trying to share that with everyone else. And I think that that is working really well. And I think it's the only way I could possibly do it. So I'm glad that it is working well. And I think that the word authenticity gets bandied around an awful lot. And it's a word that does massively give people the ick. But actually what we're talking about when we say authenticity, which is just a needlessly long word for being real. And I think I've always been really real. And I think there is something intangible about that that people feel. And that is working. And the more I do that, the more I feel that. Like I said, things have come together for me over the last 6 to 12 months. And I have really felt a shift, like an intangible, energetic shift in my business that I'm like on the right track. And that is really nice.
Yeah, I feel the same when I share fully and authentically what is going on in my business, which I do inside my membership. I feel like it's a really safe space for me to share that stuff. The response is always incredible because they don't want surface level.
No.
None of us want surface level. We want deep.
Yeah.
I was laughing when you said about the contrast, though, between looking kind of put together or looking like a bit of a mess. I'm exactly the same. And on my wedding day, I remember we'd obviously been for a venue tour. And then I turned up on the morning of my wedding and the same woman was there to welcome us. And she greeted me as I got out of the car. She looked shocked and she went, "Well, don't you scrub up well?" I thought, how offensive.
What backhanded compliment.
Oh dear. But yes, that's the contrast, isn't it? Real life versus playing dress up, I guess.
Yeah. And we all have that in us. And I think that it's a relief for other women to see that you look like a trash bag half the time.
Okay. So let's finish up with a couple of bits of advice, if you could. What do you see in terms of advice being bandied around on the internet, specifically in entrepreneurial circles, that you think is actually a load of rubbish?
My number one that I detest is fake it till you make it. Because especially for women, I think faking anything is centering on self-doubt and centering on lack and what you don't have. And I just think it diminishes what you do have. And for women who already question so much about what they do have, just the word fake it is really, really unhelpful. I think what you're doing and what the message of that is practice who you want to be. Like, yes, if you don't feel fully where you want to be, you can call in that person, you can pretend to be that person, you can, you know, I think Michelle Obama says when you're a kid, you're practicing who you're going to be when you grow up. And I like that. I think practice makes progress, but fake it, I hate. I saw something that said, it's not fake it till you make it, it's face it till you make it. Get up, do the work, you know, work hard, fail, try again, like all the stuff that is absolutely natural in business, face it till you make it. But I hate fake it till you make it.
And you've given some alternatives there, but if there was one piece of advice you could give to our listeners today as they navigate this world of entrepreneurship in 2026, what might that be?
I think it's in the same wheelhouse as fake it till you make it, but I think it's more helpful. And that is start before it's perfect. And that is acknowledging that A, perfection doesn't exist, so it will never be perfect. And B, if you don't start, you will not have the opportunity for progress at all. So, you know, when I started the podcast, I had zero guests. I had zero experience podcasting or podcast editing or writing questions. And now I'm 3 years deep and I've won an award and I've done 100 episodes. But none of those things would have happened had I not started way before it was perfect, like way when it was basically an experiment. And so I think you don't need to worry about faking anything. What you can do is just start something knowing what you know, knowing that there's more to know, and learn that as you go. Because actually, like we were saying about the whole like sharing reality thing, people want to see that anyway. So share the process and you're on to a winner.
And do you ever go, there are two schools of thought, aren't there? One is never look back. And then the two is look back and see how far you've come or learn from how awful things were back in the day. Which one do you do? Do you ever listen back to early episodes?
I actually don't really listen back to early episodes, but I know that as new people discover the podcast, they're going back and listening to the whole back catalogue. And sometimes I'm like, oh, that's so nice. And sometimes I'm like, oh my God, how shit was that? So I do look back on the business and what I've achieved and what I've done. Because I think, again, like we can be so focused on the future and what we're achieving that actually, if you don't sit and take a minute to drink in what you've actually done, that's utterly ridiculous because all you have is now. So I do look back on the business, but I don't actually listen back to the podcast.
And actually what you're doing by keeping those episodes live is you're being fully transparent and people can see the progress that you've made over the years when they stick around.
Yeah. And I think people have said to me, like, you know, you've really like come into your own as an interviewer and you keep the conversation much tighter. And they don't even know how much tighter because I used to edit so much out. Now I broadly leave the conversations as they are because I am keeping it tighter in real time. So I've learned so much as well. And every day is a school day. It's a great opportunity for learning. So everything about it I've loved. So yeah, those conversations aren't going anywhere. I still think they're the women's stories that we're sharing and it's about them ultimately and not me. Those are worth listening to regardless of how much I didn't have my shit together.
Nikki, it's been really great to chat to you today on the podcast. Thank you so much for coming on. Shortly, we're going to switch roles so that you can interview me on Women's Business. Do you know when that episode's going to come out?
That episode is coming out quite soon, like April.
Oh, awesome. So thank you so much for joining me. And I'll be back again next week. So I will see you listeners on Friday at 7 a.m. for a new episode. Until then, take care and keep marketing.